All rise. The Chief Judge and the Judges of the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals draw near for the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please take your seats. The court is called to order. This morning, we're here to hear the case of the United States versus Senior Airman Takara. Are both sides ready to argue?
Yes, Your Honor.
Yes, Your Honor.
And I understand you'd like 5 minutes to reserve?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Chief Judge Order, members of the court, may it please the court. This case is about trial defense counsel receiving damaging discovery evidence that was clearly given in anticipation of potential use and rebuttal and doing absolutely nothing with it. Now, before I get into the substance of our argument, I want to kind of switch it up and talk about relief up front because that's important for this court to consider in the context of what appellant is asking for here. Appellant is not asking for a windfall. Appellant is simply asking for a new pre-sentencing hearing free from the taint and the ineffectiveness of his trial defense counsel. So he may well get a new trial, a new sentencing hearing, and end up with the same result. Trial defense counsel was ineffective when he offered in evidence defense exhibit C, appellant's unsworn statement, when he should have known that doing so would have exposed appellant to the damaging evidence that he had received in rebuttal. Trial defense counsel was also ineffective when he failed to advise appellant not to say anything in his oral unsworn statement that would also expose him to the damaging evidence in rebuttal. Instead, trial defense counsel admitted in his own declaration that he never considered the full implications of the damaging evidence and never did anything to alter his sentencing strategy with respect to that damaging evidence.
Counsel, didn't he know for himself, the appellant, whether he committed prior misconduct? Why does he need his defense counsel to advise him on whether to tell the truth or not?
That's not what this issue is about, Your Honor. This is about appellant's Sixth Amendment right to the effective assistance of counsel.
Well, but he read the statement. He saw it. He signed it. Right? I mean, he read and signed that statement prior to making it. We've got his signature, so we're going to assume he actually saw it.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So he knows whether he committed prior misconduct.
Correct.
So if he knew he committed prior misconduct, why is he indicating to the court that he didn't?
Well, Your Honor, let me put it this way. We don't have these actual letters of reprimand. So we don't know the significance of these letters of reprimand. We don't know whether these were placed in his personal information file. We don't know if these were desk drawer LORs. We don't know that. All we have is the unsworn statement of a former supervisor at a separate base and the testimony of his wife saying that, yes, he received paperwork back in his previous assignment in North Dakota.
But what about the unsworn statement of the accused that says, I have never had any other disciplinary actions prior to this event?
Understand, Your Honor. And that's a legal term. And the second point I wanted to make is the fact that appellant in his declaration stated that he did not put that in there. He did not put that in his draft of the unsworn statement. The unsworn statement was prepared for him by trial defense counsel and the defense paralegal. And trial defense counsel never disputes that fact, never says, no, appellant put that in there. And what appears to be the case, as trial defense counsel relies in both of his declarations that he provided to this court, that, well, if you look, that's consistent with what appellant said in his response to the referral EPR. Where he made the assertion that he's never had prior disciplinary action. And trial defense counsel is wrong there in taking that beyond what it meant, because what appellant was saying in that response to the referral EPR is the only basis for this markdown is this unsubstantiated allegation which became this court-martial, and other than that, I have no prior disciplinary action. And he's clearly talking about this rating period. And it would seem that trial defense counsel took that assertion because he was representing appellant at that time and had been for 2 months up to that point, and just assumed, well, it looks like He's never had any prior paperwork, and he also says that he talked to all his supervision at Elmendorf, and there was no formal paperwork whatsoever. And again, so it's not about he knew this, because appellant didn't know the full gravamen of the assertion that trial defense counsel put in his unsworn statement. And trial defense counsel should have talked to him about the seriousness of that. And more importantly, the fact that once trial defense counsel received evidence that purported to suggest that assertion of no prior disciplinary action was untrue, at the very least, he needed to have a conversation with appellant. And he needed to advise him, like, listen, if there's been any other paperwork, you need to tell me about it. What say you with respect to these MFRs from Sergeant Blair, the prior supervisor? Trial defense counsel admits he did nothing. He never talked to appellant about the MFRs. He never disputes appellant's assertion that appellant never saw these MFRs until they were being offered into evidence. So, again, it's not about trial defense counsel's obligation.
What about the letter of reprimand?
What was that, Your Honor?
What about the letter of reprimand?
What do you mean, what about the letter of reprimand?
Did the appellant see that?
The letter of reprimand, well, again, we don't know, and again, this is, I want to continue to emphasize this point. The assertion of no prior disciplinary actions did not originate with appellant in the unsworn statement.
Got it.
And so we don't know if appellant might have thought that was an accurate statement, because once he PCS, and let's just assume that there was this LOR, and it did go in his personal information file, that once he PCS to Elmendorf, well, that letter of reprimand goes away, so therefore it doesn't matter. Or maybe it was a desk drawer LOR, and so it wasn't really disciplinary action because it wasn't really official, as it was never documented anywhere.
So he doesn't have any responsibility to clarify that with his counsel. He knows about this office. There doesn't seem to be any doubt that the guy knows that he received some form of disciplinary action, whether it's a desk or LOR or oral counseling or whatever. But he makes the assertion, a written statement to the court, that says, I have never had any other disciplinary action prior to this event. So are you telling us that he holds no responsibility for the accuracy of his own statement?
The blame is on the trial defense counsel, Your Honor, because it's the trial defense counsel that knows the process and has the constitutional duty to provide effective representation. So when trial defense counsel included that assertion in appellant's statement, he needed to, and again, it really doesn't necessarily matter before he received the evidence, but we'll talk about that now for purposes of this discussion, is that, listen, your unsworn statement, appellant, is a powerful tool in extenuation mitigation. It's an opportunity for you, unique to the military, to provide background and information on yourself for the court's use in determining your rehabilitative potential, i.e. whether or not to award a punitive discharge or not, in addition to other sentencing tools. And there's one thing that you can put in there that's extremely powerful, and that is the assertion that you've never had any prior paperwork. You never had any prior disciplinary actions, to use the term that was in there. But if you use that statement, it must be 110% true. It must be absolutely accurate. Because if it isn't, then you will expose yourself to a whole host of damaging information if the government has it in their possession. He never had that conversation with them. And then, once trial defense counsel receives evidence that suggests that statement was not true, he absolutely, at that point, had a duty to sit down and advise his client, you need to take this out of the unsworn statement, you better not say it orally, and me, as the lawyer here, I ought not to admit a statement that contains this information into evidence as he did. And that's where the ineffectiveness is in this case. And this was a two-day trial. He received this at the beginning of the first day. And this information didn't come into the trial until the second day. He had all day and all night on the 27th to do something about this, to look through the pre-sentencing case and determine whether it exposed appellant to any rebuttal. And especially in this case, where the findings portion, where there really wasn't a defense case in chief, and there wasn't much in terms of of attacking the government's case. This really was about mitigating the damage in pre-sentencing. And he did nothing with it. And the trial defense counsel even talks about this, how ineffective he was, and then he says, look, I looked at these documents when I received them, and he sees that they did not comply with the requirements of AFI 51201. They did not comply with the requirements of AFI 362907. So therefore, they weren't going to be offered in the government's case in chief. And he admits his ineffectiveness by omission because he clearly was not even thinking about the fact that these were rebuttal documents, that this was trooper evidence, it was material to the preparation of the defense, because this could come in rebuttal if the defense opened the door. And he never once thought about it. He never once thought to talk to Sergeant Blair. He never once thought to maybe, you know, do a little fact-checking and talk to Airman Appellant's wife, who was also stationed with him in North Dakota, to see whether it was true, and never even talked to Appellant about it. He did absolutely nothing, and that's the ineffectiveness here. And because of that, it really undermines the proceeding, the pre-sentencing proceedings, because it got into rehabilitative potential. And I want to make this clear that we're not saying that the military judge would have punished appellant more because it appeared that he was lying. But we do have the military judge saying that the rebuttal information that came in, that he found that was proper rebuttal, as evidence of rehabilitation potential. And that because of that, it could be considered. And when he gets this rebuttal information, it's clear that the judge took that into consideration in determining that appellant had little to no rehabilitative potential, and therefore a punitive discharge was appropriate. And had this rebuttal information not come into the proceedings because of trial defense counsel's ineffectiveness in opening the door, then the proceedings would have been different, and that's the prejudice that appellant suffered, and that he should have an opportunity to have a new pre-sentencing hearing where he's not exposed to damaging rebuttal because of his counsel's ineffectiveness.
So wasn't the basis for the objection at trial that this was cumulative?
Yes, Your Honor.
So if it's cumulative, wasn't this something the judge already knew?
No, Your Honor. Well, first of all, and let me make this point with respect to assignment of error, too. If the court disagrees with appellant's position that it was inappropriate rebuttal evidence, specifically Prosecution Exhibit 13, or that the issue is not preserved because of the cumulative objection, because it wasn't cumulative, that this court should also analyze the admission of Prosecution Exhibit 13 under ineffective assistance of counsel prong, like we noted in our brief. Because it wasn't cumulative. At the point that the assertions in the unsworn statement exposed appellant to rebuttal in several forms. One, they immediately recalled appellant's wife, who was sitting in the courtroom at the time he made the unsworn statement, to talk about the fact that he'd received prior letters of reprimand. And then the admission of prosecution's exhibits 13 and 14, which were the MFRs from Sergeant Blair, the former supervisor. And I started by talking about the MFRs because that should have been the flag for trial defense counsel to do something about this. And he could have done something like simply interview appellant's wife and she would have given him the same information, which is, as you'll note from the declaration that trial counsel submitted, was how the trial team figured it out, simply from talking to appellant's wife, that this information was out there.
Just so I understand, your argument is, I mean, he was convicted of beating up his wife and violating the order. This one piece of rebuttal information that came in was so significant that it would have turned the whole issue with respect to his sentence, basically getting the punitive discharge. You think it made that much of a difference?
Absolutely, Your Honor. I mean, the fact that this case started as an Article 15. This was an Article 15 turndown that results in a sentence of a bad conduct discharge, 140 days in reduction E1. So how does an Article 15 case become a bad conduct discharge case? I mean, and that,
I thought that had to do with respect to the violation of the order, not the assault that took place, which the downtown folks were initially going to take to trial and then gave jurisdiction back to the Air Force. So I'm not sure the turndown of the 15 was had everything to do with respect to the assaults.
Correct. Yes, Your Honor. I mean, the 15 itself was for the violation of the order. He was given a reprimand, a letter of reprimand for the off-base incident. And then when he declined the Article 15, then the government sought jurisdiction of the off-base assault and court-martialed him for that as well. But my point is that in terms of the gravity of this case, the government was simply giving him a 15 for a violation of an order and allowing the downtown folks to prosecute the domestic assault, and then it becomes a full-blown court-martial in which he gets a bad conduct discharge for something that's typically not necessarily court-martialed, domestic violence. It can be, and sometimes it's not. And the fact that he received a bad conduct discharge, Your Honor, turned on the fact that it appears that appellant was being dishonest with the court and exposing himself to information which showed that appellant appeared to have little to no rehabilitative potential, as the military judge noted. And as the government exploited as well, because the government said that there's a real question as to whether appellant regrets what happened and whether he has learned his lesson. And the military judge went one step further at the end of trial, at the end of sentencing argument, and said, hey, I just want to note for the record that I took trial counsel's statement as a comment, not on his right to remain silent, but a comment on his unsworn statement. And so, again, there's another example of it where the military judge is telling us that he was considering this, the information that came out, where the government is even arguing, hey, look, this guy is untrustworthy, he's unremorseful, because look at all the stuff that came out in rebuttal, and the military judge considering it for that fact and for his lack of rehabilitative potential. And so, again, the issue here is trial counsel did nothing. I mean, the first prong is whether or not he was effective. And there was no tactical or strategic reason for not advising the appellant of the significance of these documents. So that prong has been met, and there has been prejudice. And if anything, a military judge alone forum was to his detriment more so than a proceeding in front of members, because a military judge at least knows the mechanics of how an unsworn statement is made, that it's typically done in preparation with the trial defense counsel, and the trial defense counsel is going to have a conversation, like I mentioned earlier, with the appellant to make sure, look, everything you say in there has to be 100% true, has to be 100% accurate, and we don't want to be in a situation where there could be information that can be interpreted one way and expose yourself to rebuttal. And so a military judge hearing appellants say, hey, I've never had any prior action, and then hearing in rebuttal testimony and seeing MFR saying, yeah, this guy's had prior disciplinary action, would think this appellant, despite, you know, presumably his trial defense counsel telling him to be 100% accurate and truthful, did not do that, and in spite of the advice from counsel, still proceeded to provide inaccurate and potentially untruthful information to the court in a manner that a member's panel would not necessarily consider the full implications of that, because they wouldn't know the mechanics of how an unsworn statement is typically prepared and you know what you put in it and what you want it to say and the purpose of it. So here, having been before a military judge was even more prejudicial to appellant, because a military judge would know that and would certainly be concerned with this information and how it affects the system, you know, that this person is delivering untruthful information before the court and the negative impact that has on the system in a way that the members would not. Again, I make that point. I'm not saying that the judge punished him for potentially lying, but that he used it for evidence of a poor rehabilitative potential.
Well, let me ask you back to Chief Judge Orr's question. If you answered it, but you know, the trial defense counsel objected on a cumulative issue. Has it been preserved for appeal? He didn't object with respect to being improper rehabilitation evidence. He just argued it was cumulative to what he already received. So is that issue still before us?
Well, and that is assignment number two, yes. And appellant argues it is before this court. It is before this court. Not the objection was not the correct objection. We will concede that. It was not cumulative. The information contained in the MFRs was not cumulative with their appellant's wife's testimony. It provided additional information. However, it's preserved because the judge's ruling was that I find that this is You had witnesses and information in the unsworn statement that talked about rehab potential. Therefore, I'm considering this as rebuttal to the rehab potential information. And the issue really with assignment of error two is that it's improper rebuttal in that it's where there's numerous things. One, there's a discharge recommendation. Sergeant Blair says, I do not believe the appellant can be rehabilitated for continued service in the Air Force. That's not the standard for rehabilitative potential. That's a discharge recommendation. He even goes further at the end and says, I believe if the appellant was allowed to continue serving in the U.S. Air Force, it would negatively affect future duty assignments. Once again, that's a discharge recommendation, even though it's not expressly saying you should give this guy a discharge. I mean, that's exactly what it is. And then Sergeant Blair goes on to say that the reason why he believes that appellant has poor rehabilitative potential and should be discharged is because appellant had an attitude of wanting to get out of the Air Force since I've known him because his brother was discharged while he was in technical school. I mean, what does that have to do with anything? He's suggesting that appellant has some sort of axe to grind with the Air Force. And he said, well, goes on to say he's also had a problem of lying to supervisors and supervision. And yeah, I've found him lying on many occasions. Again, that's not proper rebuttal evidence in terms of rebutting rehab potential. This is just a straight out.
Those are judges presumed to know all of this, so we can sift through that, what's acceptable, what's not. So why wouldn't we assume that the military judge in this case was able to determine what was proper information and sift through it and say this was not proper?
Because of what the military judge said, Your Honor. He said, I'm going to overrule the objection. I find that the letter from Staff Sergeant Blair references opinion about rehabilitation potential of the accused, which you asked both your witnesses about. Also, Airman Takar made statements in his unsworn about wanting to stay in the Air Force. According to Staff Sergeant Blair, he's giving a different opinion in the past that is directly rebuttal to the unsworn statement. And then he goes on to say, I do find that to be a fact in the unsworn statement and opinion to make it clear for the appellate court, I want to stay in the Air Force. And again, he's rebutting. The military judge is saying you can rebut opinions with opinions, and that's not the state of the law. And the fact of whether I want to stay in the Air Force is not the type of fact that CAP had in mind that can be rebutted. It's not an assertion it may be an assertion of fact, but it's not the type of fact that can be rebutted, because it may well have been the case that appellant didn't want to stay in the Air Force back when he was stationed in North Dakota, but now he changed his mind. So to say, well, I'm going to rebut his assertion now with what he told me 2 years ago, that's not the type of rebuttal evidence that CAF authorizes.
Why not? He's given a perception to the court that he wants to stay in the Air Force, and yet he's told five or six different people that, in fact, I don't want to stay in the Air Force. Why isn't that something that's proper rebuttal to dissuade that perception to say this is not what he really means? He's making this up before the court.
Well, Your Honor, that may well be the case, and then this court needs to turn to 403, and the fact that, well, that may be the case that I disagree, he doesn't want to stay in the Air Force. It doesn't give Sergeant Blair the license, and it doesn't give the military judge the license to say to the military judge to consider that Sergeant Blair thinks he should be discharged. So even if the court finds, well, that's appropriate rebuttal that he can rebut that assertion, it still should not come in under MRE 403 because it's overly prejudicial in the manner of how it's delivered, and the fact it's delivered in the form of a not-so-subtle discharge recommendation. So again, just to emphasize for the court, unless there are any other questions, all appellant is seeking is a new pre-sentencing hearing free from the taint of the ineffectiveness of his counsel, the opportunity to go before a sentencing authority, have them review the evidence in the case, and have the benefit of effective representation during that hearing. Thank you.
Chief Judge Orr, members of the court, may it please the court, I am Captain Erica Slager, and along with Mr. Roger Bruce, I represent the government in this matter. Appellant created his own issue through lying and now wants to reap the benefit of his own misconduct. He lied to his defense counsel on numerous occasions about his prior disciplinary history and now attempts to frame it as ineffective assistance of counsel. He claims he's not asking for a windfall, but that is exactly what he's asking for. This issue would not exist at all except for appellant's lies. This is an ineffective assistance counsel for three reasons. First, Captain A.R. met his obligation to investigate. We know. Secondly, Captain A.R.'s performance was not so deficient as to not be functioning as a counsel guaranteed by the Sixth Amendment. And finally, the appellant was not prejudiced. We know that Captain A.R. met his duty to investigate because his affidavit states he met with co-workers, supervisors, appellant, including the first sergeant, flight chief, raider, reviewed the PIF, the UIF, and other personnel records, and none of this showed any disciplinary history.
When did he question Sergeant's letter?
Your Honor, the standard of that Captain A.R. is held to is standard of fallible defense attorneys. He's not held to an impossible standard. He's not held to perfection. He was handed this NFR as he was walking into court the morning that court started.
So does that relieve him of responsibility to look at what that evidence is and take it into account and determine what's in the best interest of his client?
He acted as an appropriate defense counsel would.
By not questioning the person who says a brand new piece of information with respect to disciplinary action he didn't know existed. The defense counsel didn't know existed. How is that reasonable efforts by the defense counsel? I'll grant you from the, you don't have to go back to every single supervisor, I understand that, but when he is given this evidence over a two-day trial and it says something he's not aware of, why didn't he pick up the phone, make some efforts? And because he did not do that, why isn't that unreasonable of his part?
While in a perfect trial he would have done that, in this case we don't parse each decision that defense counsel makes. We look for what's the standard of competency in sentencing. We look at the facts of a case like U.S. v. Davis, where it was held to be IAC because the defense based their entire sentencing case around asking for as much time in confinement as possible in order to save the appellant's retirement under TARA. After trial was over, after he was given a life sentence, they found out that he was not eligible for this TARA program to save his retirement at all. That's the type of case where we find ineffective assistance of counsel. We also found it in a case, Padilla v. Kentucky, where they didn't advise the client that if he pled guilty, he would be deported, where they easily could have found that out. That's the type of case. We don't parse out each decision that a defense counsel makes in the entire sentencing case.
But his own affidavit says he got this information and didn't think to go back and look at what he had previously done with respect to the unsworn statement. So he admits he didn't do his job, did he?
He did not go back at the time, but that is placing all of the blame on the defense counsel when appellant conveniently ignores the fact that he lied to his defense counsel repeatedly over the course of months.
I'm looking at what the defense counsel's responsibility is, counsel. That's what I'm looking at. Not just from the accused's position, but from the defense counsel's responsibility to his client. Once he got information he was not aware of, what did he do with it, and was it a reasonable effort on his part to investigate? And by his own admission, he did nothing with it. He didn't think it was going to be admissible. And just basically, by his own admission, ignored it. Or dropped the ball, however you want to phrase it.
Yes, Your Honor. However, when taken in light of Strickland v. Washington, it says that we shall make every effort to eliminate the distorting effects of hindsight and evaluate the conduct from counsel's perspective at the time.
So I'm too busy at the morning of trial, and therefore I don't have to worry about it. Is that the standard we ought to set?
According to the standard that the Supreme Court set out in Strickland, counsel did meet the duty of a reasonable, fallible attorney when you take away the distorting effects of hindsight. However, Your Honor, Strickland also says that if it's easier to dispose of this ineffective assistance counsel claim on prejudice, that we should move to that. And I'd like to address the prejudice in the fact that the appellant suffered no prejudice, so as in the Strickland case says, so serious as to deprive the defendant of a fair trial, a trial whose result is reliable. In this case, the appellant failed to show prejudice, and it is his burden. Strickland says the defendant must show that counsel's representation fell below an objective standard of reasonableness, and that but for counsel's errors, a different result. That did not happen here. This alleged IAC was during sentencing, after the appellant had been convicted, contrary to his pleas, and the facts are exceptionally egregious. In this case, the appellant coerced his wife, his ex-wife, to pick him up when she was volunteering for Airman Ginn's drunk driving. After she tried to drop him off, he grabbed her keys, threw them in the back. When she tried to reach for him, he grabbed her, threw her down. She started honking the horn, dialing her phone, screaming, ran out of the car. This caused so much commotion that at least six people came out and watched this take place. He chased her, he body slammed her into the ground, drug her back, shoved her in the garage. This resulted in bleeding, stitches, scarring. When the police arrived on the scene, she stumbled out begging for help. For appellant to claim that his lie that ended up in rebuttal caused his sentence of 140 days in a BCD and reduction to E1 is ridiculous. He was sentenced for his actions. He was sentenced to less than what trial counsel asked for and far less than what the maximum sentence was. He got this sentence for his actions, not for the lying. This was in front of a military judge, not members. Military judges are used to this sort of thing. Their passions don't become inflamed from a lie from the accused. He also was not charged with false official statement or anything like that. And as you said earlier, judges are presumed to know and follow the law. And in this case, the judge knew that he should sentence on the crimes of which the appellant was convicted. Additionally, this lie was already in evidence prior to the unsworn statement, since it was in his EPR rebuttal, his referral EPR rebuttal statement. So in summary, if appellant is given relief on this issue, it means that he gets relief for his own lie. It's this lie that prevents appellant from meeting his burden under Strickland. The appellant had the chance to fix this lie at many turns. When he drafted his unsworn statement, when he reviewed it, when he signed it, and when he read it. And he shirked his opportunity at every turn. Captain Ayer's conduct met the standard of a reasonable attorney under the circumstances without the distorting effects of hindsight. And appellant was not prejudiced because in the end result, the results of his trial was reliable. Turning now to the second issue, I'd like to address the military judge's admission of rebuttal evidence. In this issue, appellant takes issue with Prosecution Exhibit 13. Appellant forfeited this issue. The only objection was to cumulativeness. And under U.S. v. Esslinger, failure to object to the admission of evidence at trial forfeits appellate review, absent plain error. Prosecution Exhibit 13 was multi-use evidence. Portions of it were rehab potential evidence, which clearly they would be allowed to ask their witnesses about, because the defense had asked their witnesses about it. Portions of it were retention evidence. Again, though, that would also be allowable. He had demonstrated that he had, and the trial counsel can rebut the appellant's state of mind as to wanting to stay in. In U.S. v. Esslinger, it was a case where people stated they wanted the accused in the unit, and trial counsel could rebut that this wasn't the consensus. The main issue that was addressed in appellant's original brief was whether the military judge erroneously admitted rebuttal evidence in response to an opinion in the unsworn statement. A review of the record clearly shows that this was a slip of the tongue. We know this by looking at a couple different things. One is by the context. In the case of U.S. v. Perkins, the military judge mistakenly announced that the accused had pled guilty to spec 3 of the charges, 3, and when he actually had pled guilty to spec 3 of charge 2. The court found that because the intent of the military judge was sufficient to know what she meant, that the appellant was not substantially prejudiced. Also in U.S. v. Dilday, it states, words which convey the meaning and intent of the jury are deemed to be sufficient so long as it manifests a decision upon the issues. In this case, we know that the military judge meant to say it is a fact not an opinion. He left out the word not. We know this because, again, the military judge is presumed to know the law and follow it. And in this case, we in particular know that because he called out to the appellate court, I'm making it clear for the appellate court, this is a fact and opinion, when he meant to say not an opinion. If he didn't know that such a rule existed, he wouldn't have addressed it at all.
Well, how do we know this is, I mean, the guy says, I want to stay in the Air Force. Why is that a fact and not an opinion? And he cites the case law that says that a personal assertion about what he wants that he wants to stay in the Air Force, would be a fact and not his own personal desire or...
Yes, Your Honor. This is comparable to Cleveland and also the Mann's case. In Cleveland, the appellant said, I feel that I have served well. The court held that this was not enough to allow in evidence of prior misconduct. By having the appellant state, I feel something, that is not enough. In Mann's, however, which is much more analogous to the case at hand, he stated, I have tried throughout my life to stay within the laws and regulations of this country. The court held that this was a statement of fact. This is similar to the appellant's case where he stated that he wants to stay in the Air Force. There is nothing feely about that. He's not saying, I feel that maybe I would like to stay in the Air Force. No, he stated a fact, I want to stay in the Air Force.
How is that a fact? I'm still not quite sure to understand how that's a fact and not his personal opinions on what I can come up with, but that's how he feels, right? I mean, I want to stay in the Air Force. I don't want to stay in the Air Force. That's for him and him alone to decide. So how is that a fact?
At the time that he stated it, maybe his opinion changed, maybe his thoughts changed later, but at the time he held out to the court in writing that he wanted to stay in the Air Force. At that time that he held that out to the court, trial counsel is permitted to rebut his state of mind at that time with other facts.
He's allowed to rebut a fact, not an opinion, right? I mean, that's
correct.
The law. You can't rebut an opinion.
That is correct, Your Honor. That is correct, Your Honor. And he held it out as a fact. It is very, very similar to Mann's, where he said, I have tried throughout my life to stay within the laws and regulations of this country, when they had evidence that he had prior convictions.
And I don't mean to be taken from other judges, but how do we know that the military judge, in fact, said this was a fact? I know you said we can read into it, but isn't it a possible other reading would be that he found it as a matter of fact this guy had voiced his opinion about this issue before? That would be a fact, as he has given his opinion on this issue. That would be something the judge can say, yeah, you've done it or you haven't done it based on evidence. But it would still be an opinion. If it is an opinion, should this evidence have come in to rebut that opinion? Isn't that one way to read the military judge's decision on this? Because he simply said, it's a fact you made this opinion for.
Your Honor, we feel it's apparent from the case law and what the judge said in regards to make it clear for the appellate court that he knew that he could only allow in rebuttal evidence to a fact, not an opinion. However, if this court does decide that it's ambiguous and needs clarification, we offer to perhaps send it back to the military judge for his clarification and what he meant, just much like we do with convening authorities with ambiguous actions. However, it is still our position that it is clear that this is a fact, that appellant was stating, I want to stay in the Air Force, and therefore was that statement of fact was able to be rebutted by rebuttal evidence. Appellant portrays Staff Sergeant Blair's opinion that appellant wanted to get out of the Air Force as highly prejudicial. However, he fails to show what this prejudice could be. He was sentenced for viciously beating his ex-wife, causing the bleeding, stitches, and terror. And a statement that at one time the appellant wanted to get out of the Air Force is highly prejudicial is hardly highly prejudicial. In conclusion, Prosecution Exhibit 13 was properly admitted and did not unfairly prejudice the appellant. We therefore ask this court to affirm the appellant's sentence. Thank you.
Well, I've got another question.
Yes, Your Honor.
If you find this was in fact an opinion, this is a fact, then what should we do with it then? We find that that this was improper rehabilitation evidence that came in because the accused or the felon raised an opinion about wanting to stay in. I'm not sure I heard you. What do we do then?
Your Honor, even if it was erroneously admitted, the appellant was not prejudiced in this. He was sentenced to 140 days for viciously beating his wife, causing her scarring and stitches, hospital. He was not 140 days in a BCD. It's apparent from that sentence that he was sentenced for his crime, not for this evidence, and he was not prejudiced. If there's no further questions, thank you.
It doesn't matter that whether an appellant was lying or not. That's not the issue here. Again, we don't have, that may be well the case, but it's, bears repeating that the assertion of no prior disciplinary actions was not included in, did not originate with appellant, it originated with trial defense counsel. He did not discuss the full implications of that. And as appellant said in his declaration, I deferred on the unsworn statement to my trial defense counsel just like I did everything else. And he may not have known the full gravamen. He told me to say this, so I said it. He told me to sign this, so I signed it. He told me to go before a judge alone, so I went before a judge alone.
Wait, you're telling us that he has no responsibility in his own action. You just told us it doesn't matter whether the accused was lying. I mean, I kind of have a problem with that. So he's allowed to portray this and then come back later and say, yeah, I was lying about it, but my counsel didn't tell me what to do, so therefore I'm off the hook.
I understand what you're saying, Your Honor. It would appear that appellant doesn't necessarily come to this court here today with the cleanest of hands. But it's the responsibility of his trial defense counsel to ensure that he effectively represents his client. He did not do that here. So while appellant may be at some fault, anything that he did that may have been inappropriate could have easily been cured by trial defense counsel's effective representation and telling him, look, you can't say things that aren't true, you can't say things that are inaccurate, et cetera, et cetera. And in that way, trial defense counsel did not meet the standard expected of fallible lawyers. He did absolutely nothing with this information. So regardless of what appellant said or what trial defense counsel didn't find, the moment he had this evidence, he needed to do something with it, and he did nothing. He talked to no one. He didn't interview the person who wrote the MFR. He didn't run it by appellant. He didn't check the unsworn statement. He didn't run it by his sentencing witnesses. He did nothing. And that's why he did not meet the standard and he was ineffective. And then the issue becomes prejudice. And unless this court is 100% confident that appellant would have gotten the sentence he received, regardless of this information that came in a rebuttal, then appellant was prejudiced. And the fact that he probably would not have received this sentence is clear. The fact that the military judge would not have considered information which seemed to suggest that appellant had little to no rehabilitative potential. Trial counsel would not have had the opportunity to argue appellant's lack of remorse, which the military judge specifically said he took as a comment on appellant's unsworn statement. And this case is more like Cleveland than Mann's turning. Let me make one quick point, because I think I wasn't very articulate with this when I got up before, when I mentioned the 15 turndown. I mentioned that because this was a case where, period, the government was not seeking a bad conduct discharge, i.e. they were not seeking to prosecute him for the domestic violence until the 15 was turned down, and then they sought jurisdiction. So this is, and what I meant by that was the appellant probably would not have received a bad conduct discharge because of the 15 turndown, because they would have never prosecuted him for the domestic violence. He may well have been administratively separated or whatever, but that's neither here nor there. So that's the point I was trying to make with respect to the 15 turndown, in terms of whether this court can be 100% confident that appellant would have received the sentence he did but for trial defense counsel's ineffectiveness. And then finally, just turning briefly to assignment of error two, this case is more like Cleveland than Mann's. This is a case where I feel like something. It isn't the situation in Mann's where I feel like I've tried to stay, I've lived within the bounds of the law. Well, Your Honor, here's some evidence that this guy's got convictions for stuff. I mean, that's clearly a rebuttable assertion, because there's objective evidence to show that it's not necessarily accurate. Whereas simply a pure assertion of opinion that is outside the scope of what is intended in rebuttal. And once again, finally, Emory 403 does not allow an assertion that I want to stay in the Air Force to be rebutted by, well, no, he doesn't want to stay in the Air Force, and you should discharge him as well. Unless there are further questions, that concludes our presentation. Thank you, Chief Upter. Judge Orr.
All right. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. We found them helpful, and we'll have a lot of discussion as a result of them. There being no further evidence, before the case, before the court is adjourned. And we'll have a decision in due course.